morning.
Good morning.
And we are going to have an informational meeting concerning the how you call it, Oregon Growth Account. We are glad to have a representative, Mitch Greenley, joining us this morning. Welcome.
Thank you for allowing me to join you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and we'd like you to have join us again sometime in the future, whenever you can. And with that, I'd like to begin the informational meeting with Ron Smith. Ron Schmidt, Director of Investment, Oregon State Treasury, and also then Mike Mueller, Assistant Director of Investment, Oregon State Treasury. Could you come up together, please? Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Ron Schmitz, Director of Investments for Oregon State Treasury. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund investments in the state of Oregon. I'm going to start out talking about the implementation of House Bill 3613 and the activities there, and then Mike Mueller, Assistant Director, will talk about the Oregon Growth Account and those activities. In reality, OPERF, the pension fund investment in the state of Oregon, began well before House Bill 3613. However, that bill represents a key point in the discussion and really in the last few years, perhaps the primary point in the discussion of in-state investing. It might be worth just taking a minute to talk a little bit about the key provisions of the bill and what the OIC is working under. It was passed in 2003, as you probably know. Pertinent provisions of the bill create a duty for the Oregon Investment Council to look to Oregon first for opportunities for diversification and venture capital investments unless not prudent to do so. Requires $100 million in venture capital investments unless, again, it's not prudent under the circumstances to do so. Okay. And finally, the bill makes a finding that investments in startup and emerging growth businesses and minority and women-owned businesses can be produced as substantial positive returns for long-term investors. The reference to prudence in the bill we think is very important, as the OIC as well as Treasury staff has a legal fiduciary duty to invest for the benefit of beneficiaries of the pension fund assets, and that means we have to balance risk and reward. Return has to be the primary driver. Economic development can be a secondary add-on benefit, but can't be the primary driver of the investment decisions. Some OPERF holdings, such as McCormick & Schmick and KinderCare, clearly don't qualify as emerging growth businesses, but that is part of the $470 million that is already invested in the state through the private equity portion of the OPERF portfolio. Notable firms that do classify as emerging growth businesses are firms such as Pixelworks, AtOnce.com, and MaxViz, and there are many others. If I may, then, just with that as a little bit of preliminary background, implementation of 3613 and what's been done to date. The Oregon Investment Council has adopted a three-pronged approach to trying to meet the mandates of the bill, and it might be worth going to. You should have in front of you a little schematic.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Pardon me for interrupting, but could Mr. Schmidt please tell us how the Oregon Investment Council is comprised?
Oh, sure. There are six members of the Oregon Investment Council, four appointed by the governor from the population at large, the state treasurer, and then there's a non-voting member who is the executive director of PERS.
A what member, sorry?
A non-voting member.
Oh. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, as you go along, members the first time that is serving in this T&E committee. So if you, when you use acronyms or any names, please explain it so we can understand better.
Sure. Joe, I will try very much to do so, and I'm afraid that we're rife with acronyms in our business. And just to be clear, then OPERF stands for the Public Employees Retirement System Fund. That's the primary vehicle that is oriented toward with respect to 3613. If we can look at the schematic, this is kind of a simplified version of what the private equity program looks like within OPERF. It is good for conceptual purposes, but I don't want anybody to be under the mistaken impression that this kind of represents the whole program, because you just couldn't fit what all the pieces on a page. But if I could start you out on the left-hand side of the page, you see that there's direct investment in funds by the OIC, supported by Treasury staff and by an outside private equity investment consultant. That constitutes $4 billion of the roughly $48 billion in the PERS program. That $4 billion of fair market value, there's an additional approximately $4 billion of capital that's been committed but not yet drawn down and funded into specific underlying companies. What the OIC does in this direct program is hire the kind of the teal blue colored box or the light blue colored box, hires funds, which are comprised of, we would be a limited partnership interest in a fund with a general partner. The general partner manages the fund, collects a fee, and shares in the profits of the underlying company investments, if any, that are made, and usually there are, knock on wood. Each of those funds then in turn would invest in 10 to 20 individual companies. The direct program is largely a nationally focused program. It's looking at large funds and large investments just by the nature of the size of OPERF assets and the limitations on staff and the business orientation skill sets of the private equity consultant tends to look at the larger tier partnerships that exist across the country. It is not specifically Oregon-focused, but Oregon investments do come out of that, but it's more trickle-down, if you will, rather than bottom-up driven. The Oregon Investment Council has, since 3613, has earmarked that 5 to 10% of that program be specifically targeted to venture capital, whereas historically in the past it was primarily more management buyout and corporate finance oriented. So that would be one prong, if you will, of a three-pronged approach to you know, getting capital invested here in the state. If you will, then the middle portion of the schematic shows fund-to-funds managers, Grove Street Capital and Pathway Capital. In this case, the council would hire a manager to manage a pool of partnerships. And the reason you do that and add that extra layer, and it is an extra layer of cost, admittedly, but you do that to get some expertise that you can't get through the direct program on our own, just through staffing limitations and as I mentioned, the radar screen of the consultant we work with is primarily large firms. So the strategy here in the fund-to-funds program, which is $500 million, is to look at smaller partnerships, some of them regionally focused, some of them purely national. Like the direct investment program, once you get beyond the fund-to-funds manager layer, you're investing in individual funds as a limited partner with general partnership characteristics. Those funds in turn invest in companies. So the blue and orange portions of the box, the boxes as shown on the schematic, are very much the same under all three of the programs. The main difference here is you've got a layer of fund-to-fund manager to bring specified expertise to the table that we just don't have at the staff level.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mr. Schmitz, what are the funds in the first area?
You need some names?
Yes.
There were KKR, for example, Texas Pacific Group, Joseph Littlejohn and Company.
Yeah, list of those.
There's a list in the Treasurer's Annual Report, and we can certainly make one available to you as a follow-up.
So KKR and?
KKR, Texas Pacific Group.
Texas Pacific and?
Joseph Littlejohn and Company. There's about 50 partnerships.
So I'm just trying to get a feeling for
the
type of funds that are there. Okay, and then in the second group follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, go on.
Please, could you give us an example of who those funds would be? Are they the same?
No, they would be very, very different funds, and to be honest, I can't think of an individual fund name. We have our primary dealings, at least at my level, my primary dealing is with the fund-to-funds manager, not the partnerships themselves. But we can certainly get that to you.
Thank you.
But it is very different partnerships, and it's intended to be complementary, and that's why it's a separate program and not part of the bigger, you know, the bigger, broader pool. The interesting thing to note here in that middle section, the fund-to-funds program there, that is 50% roughly oriented toward venture capital and emerging growth businesses. So even though it's smaller assets, it is more focused on emerging growth businesses and will likely, you know, end up with more of the targeted kind of investments that 3613 envisions, you know, falling through to the bottom line, if you will.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mr. Schmidt, in the first group, what portion of that $4 billion is invested in Oregon?
I don't know a percentage number, but it's there's about $470 million in private equity that's invested in Oregon or Oregon-based companies.
In the first, group?
Well, that would actually include both boxes.
Okay, so could you find out how much is in the first and the second? So we're talking out of $4.5 billion. I'm just trying to understand. Out of $4.5 billion, only 10% is invested in Oregon.
That's correct.
Thank you.
We Treasury staff anticipates into a $300 million additional commitment in this fund of funds box to Grove Street Capital. That's coming up in the next few months, subject, of course, to OIC approval. OIC is the Oregon Investment Council. Sorry. The final box on the right-hand side of the page, then, is another fund-to-funds program. That one is very specific, specifically mandated to Oregon. It's called the Oregon Investment Fund, in fact. It's a $100 million commitment by the OIC to the program. It's managed by Credit Suisse First Boston, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Credit Suisse First Boston puts $5 million of its own money into the program alongside our money, and then they will manage 8 to 10 partnerships, about approximately 80% of the fund targeted toward partnership investments, and then 20% held in reserve for direct co-investments in Oregon companies as they surface through the general partnership activities. That program is indeed extremely Oregon-focused. It does broaden the definition, though, to Pacific Northwest, and we'll talk about why that's necessary in just a second. And this $100 million isn't intended to be, and I think it's often confused with the $100 million mandate from 3613, that the two amounts are really coincidental. It was just our typical initial investments in funds range from $50 to $100 million in first-time investments, and this is a first-time investment with Credit Suisse First Boston, so I want to make sure that the $100 million aren't equated in your minds. We can grow that $100 million and anticipate that it might.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Schmidt, could you tell me why do we use Credit Suisse First Boston?
I was just getting to that, yes.
Yeah. Oh, good. Thank you.
But if I may, first...
Besides their $5 million they put in.
Sure. Well, first, it might be worth talking about why a fund-to-funds approach was chosen with respect to 3613, just very briefly, and then I'll get into why Credit Suisse First Boston. By statute, Treasury staff can't make direct investments in equities. And, you know, after the passage of 3613, we received a lot of business plans from entrepreneurs, you know, looking for capital, looking for investment, of course. And we couldn't, by statute, do anything with it except pass it along to general partners that we thought might have an interest in that particular strategy or that particular investment idea. Frankly, even without that legal restriction, we aren't staffed to make direct investments in companies. It's a different thing to invest in partnerships where you're looking at broad strategic initiatives than it is to get into the micro evaluation of individual companies. Even if we had the ability to add the FTEs, probably public fund pay scales wouldn't allow us to attract the kind of talent we need to do that kind of specific investment. So we really felt that, and the council felt that, a fund-to-funds approach was the best way to go. finally, by creating the fund of funds or going with a fund of funds approach, we could create, as I mentioned earlier, the ability to do co-investments, which is a good way to leverage the investment in the partnerships. And that's an investment that's side by side with the partnership, but outside of the partnership's fee structures. So it's cost effective, and it's a way to really lever up the amount of out of the partnerships. The Oregon opportunities that do come along can really get levered up through this co-investment program. So that's kind of in broad terms why we felt fund of funds was important or the way to go. Why Credit Suisse First Boston? Why a New York firm to manage Oregon investments? To be honest, and unfortunately, I think, but there aren't any qualified institutional quality fund of funds managers in Oregon that have run in-state programs, have experience nurturing budding entrepreneurs, working with the tech transfer community, and attracting, and this is a key point that we think Credit Suisse brings to the table, attracting key national and regional venture capital relationships from across the country to entice them to look into Oregon. And that's a big part of what the Credit Suisse program will do.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Quinley.
Thank you. Those first two objectives, nurturing budding entrepreneurs and expanding the state university technology transfer programs, are they written into your contract with Credit Suisse First Boston as functions that you're asking them to do?
Perhaps not that specifically, Representative Greenlee, Chairman, but the contract is very Oregon-focused and draws on these kind of activities as the focus of the manager's efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Additional rationale on Credit Suisse First Boston, they are the largest private equity manager in the world. They have affiliates that do venture capital investing. They have a large merchant banking operation, fund-to-funds activity, management activities, as well as customized activities, very specific customized activities, and a large private placement operation that gives them a reach that's really unprecedented in the private equity community. And we thought that brought a lot to bear for the goals that we had for 3613. They have experience doing this in other states. Both as individuals prior to joining Credit Suisse, and Credit Suisse has done similar programs to what we've asked them to do here in Oregon and other states. A key factor, as I mentioned earlier, was their ability to do co-investments, and not only to do co-investments, but to do direct investments, so that at some point down the road, they would not only rely on just the general partner making co-investment opportunities available to them, they would be able to source their own investments through their exhaustive investment banking activities and private leasing arms and a lot of different business initiatives that they have that can bring investments to the table. They have a team and the ability to evaluate those and make those kind of investments, which is more of a downstream issue. It's not something you anticipate right away. If I may, I'd like to talk a little bit about the objectives of the Oregon Investment Fund.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Schmidt, before we leave Credit Suisse, what do they make on their arrangements?
It's approximately a 60 basis point management fee, and they get 5% of the profits, which is much lower than the typical fund of funds program, which is a 1% management fee and 10% of the profits.
Thank you.
The primary objective of the Oregon Investment Fund, as I mentioned, is to achieve superior rate of return while contributing to the economic development of the state. The focus of this program is in whole or in part opportunities in Oregon. It does allow for a focus on the Pacific Northwest as well. Why it's not Oregon only, I think, is important to talk about a little bit. General partners don't define their strategies or their funds by state or by small geographic regions. They may be regional, i.e. Pacific Northwest or West Coast or west of the Mississippi or something like that, but you don't find that their definition of their investment strategies is a single state. They're more prone to define, you know, certain technologies they're interested in, certain types of businesses they're interested in, and when there's a geographic focus, then most narrow it gets is regional, not statewide. So that was sort of a necessity of the industry to have that broader definition. But make no mistake, those objectives are Oregon first, Northwest second, and so on. There are additional objectives that the program seeks to find, and these are written into our agreement with Credit Suisse. That is to foster the creation of emerging growth opportunities in Oregon, including women and minority-owned interests, minority-owned companies, encourage the development of a vibrant venture capital and private equity community, and a key thing is to attract investments to the area from regional and national firms. So it's to get more than just our money looking at Oregon opportunities. It's to get money from across the country looking at Oregon opportunities. As I mentioned, Oregon investment's not mandated. There's no requirement that $100 million that Credit Suisse has all goes into Oregon. I think I've tried to cover why we needed to do that. But again, the focus of the activity is Oregon. More importantly, Credit Suisse in its relationships with its general partners has what they call a side letter. That side letter requires the general partners to do a number of things. Number one, invest in Oregon companies an amount at least equal to the amount that was given by the OIF into their fund. Secondly, the GPs are required to I think I lost my voice.
I lost my hearing.
I didn't touch anything. I probably really don't. The general partners must consider women and minority-owned investments in the fund. The general partners must be present in Oregon, actively seeking and evaluating Oregon opportunities for a specified number of days per month. That'll be probably vary by fund by fund. That won't be a set number for any that cuts across to all the partnerships. And they must establish an Oregon office. Finally, the general partners will report regularly to Credit Suisse First Boston on Oregon-related deal flow, what companies they've looked at, what opportunities they've looked at, what they reviewed, why they have no interest in the cases where they've turned down the investment, what they like and why, what's kind of in the pipeline, what they're working on that's currently active, and indeed for those investments they do make, how the investment's going, what stage of activity is going on, and so on and so forth. Credit Suisse then in turn reports to us, and we have a requirement to report back to the legislature annually. And finally, the key thing, and I've mentioned it before, so I apologize for being repetitive, but the co-investment, 20% of that fund is earmarked for co-investment, and that will be Oregon-specific opportunities, and it's a way to really lever the dollars that are find their way into Oregon opportunities through the broader program to really leverage up those commitments and that assistance, if you will, to Oregon emerging businesses. If I may, just a second on progress to date. I think it was August of last year that the legal work and all the negotiation and so forth was finally completed on the documents with Credit Suisse. They have named an advisory board. There are eight local citizen members, two from Treasury, six from the business community at large, venture capitalists or financial leaders. An RFP was developed, a request for proposal was developed. It was mailed out to 121 firms, 74 additional firms downloaded the RFP from a website, Credit Suisse website. And at the end of the day, 26 partnerships responded to the questionnaire. Those partnerships ranged were based in Oregon, Washington, California, Idaho, and Pennsylvania. I would say that Pennsylvania is just an interesting element that why we think this approach was attractive. It's a nationally known, well-known venture capital firm. It doesn't have quite the same name recognition, perhaps, as some of those Silicon Valley firms. But they have an interest in expanding their operation from being solely in the Northeast to looking west and very interested in Oregon and through this program hope to establish an office here. Those discussions are ongoing. Hopefully they'll reach fruition, but we can't obviously have any guarantees on that. Out of the 26 respondents, Credit Suisse looked at identified 12 to 13 funds with the help of the advisory committee, but it's really Credit Suisse's decision as to what investments to make. Those firms were invited to New York to make presentations to the investment team from Credit Suisse. After those meetings, Credit Suisse representatives will go out to the place of domicile of these remaining partnerships that are under consideration and do continuing due diligence there on site. We expect that during 2005 that they would identify approximately six funds that they will invest in, probably an average of $10 million per fund, you know, somewhere between $5 and $10 million, depending on the size of the fund and the strategy. I think one to two funds will be announced very shortly in the next couple of months. I'm pretty sure that one of them will be an Oregon-based general partnership. One of them will not be an Oregon company. But again, their focus will be looking at Oregon opportunities. In 2006, we'll have a repeat of the RFP process and do a similar winnowing down and try to make another, you know, five to six general partnership investments at that time. And then once that is completed and this first $100 million is placed, the OIC will have the opportunity then to increase the investment, do additional investing with Credit Suisse, go a different direction, or both, with respect to trying to implement what 3613 was after. On page five of your handout, there's just a little bit on partnership evaluation criteria. I think in the interest of time, it's probably not something we need to go over now, but this is consistently applied by Credit Suisse across all of their fund-to-funds operations, including the customized in-state programs that they do for other states as well as Oregon. So it creates a consistent evaluation criteria. So in conclusion, I would state that the 3613 identifies 2008 as the completion date for the in-state initiative to get the $100 million placed. We believe that the OIC's three-pronged approach to looking at investments and making investments will be an effective way to live up to the dictates of 3613. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Greenleaf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. Ron, this is a nice report. It makes things very specific. And those side letters, of course, are going to be very important. We've talked before about this question of nurturing budding entrepreneurs and fostering university transfer. And I wonder if you've had a chance to think of what other things we might do, what might be proposed to this committee or other committees that would increase the ability to foster Oregon budding entrepreneurs and we're going to hear about the Oregon Growth Account in a bit, and I know that's one piece of this, but I wonder if you've had a chance to think about what we might propose, say, for OECDD or other kinds of techniques to help sweep deals towards CSFB.
Representative Greenleaf Cherlem, it's a great question and a tough question. I honestly believe that Oregon opportunities get looked at much more than many of you think they do. You know, having a business opportunity isn't the same as that business opportunity being one that you know, it makes it to an investment by a general partner. So in other words, every idea isn't necessarily a good idea, even though there may be a lot of ideas out there. There's a lot of venture capital money available in general, more than ever. And if you look at the long sweep of history, more money has been raised in the last 5-6 years in venture capital than probably the prior 20 years combined. So I don't know that there's an issue with respect to availability of money per se. Now, getting money, or getting that money to look at Oregon is a slightly different twist on the question and a more complicated issue. We certainly think that this program will go a long way to doing that, and not only by the partnerships that are hired by Credit Suisse, but also their ability to do what they call sidecar investments and specific investments that might be a one-off investment, if you will, for a fund that's not in the state currently and will be looking at the state. But with respect to specific activities or specific duty things that the legislature might do, for example, I have to claim ignorance as to I'm not sure that that's my bailiwick to think in those terms, but the Economic Development Office is probably would be a key player in anything along those lines, and I don't frankly know enough about how they're funded or what resources they have available to them. But certainly Credit Suisse is there's
Marty Brantley, I think, is kind of a friend of the advisory board. I don't think he's a formal member of the advisory board in the Credit Suisse program, but there is contact between he and his shop and Credit Suisse, and I'd be more than happy to sort of ask that specific question, and I know you've asked it of me once before, but I'm afraid I don't have any golden nuggets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you very much. I wanted you to help me understand the news stories regarding the investment in Texas Pacific, where the Army Investment Council made a decision, and then you said today that you don't have the power to make the decision to invest in specific investment opportunities, and obviously I'm missing some connection between the two. Can you explain that to me?
Sure, Representative Merkley, Chairman. What I meant to say, or was trying to say, is the Treasury staff is not empowered to make direct investments in companies, the underlying companies of a general partnership. We're precluded, and I don't know the statute number right offhand, but I can get it for you. But we cannot. We can own bonds. We can buy bonds directly, but we can't directly invest in common stock or in equity investments. So we invest in these partnerships. The partnerships, in turn, invest in the underlying companies.
Okay. If I could follow up, I was reading an article yesterday about California controller's efforts to establish a higher standard for investing related to corporate governance issues. Has that been an issue at all with or an activity of the Oregon Investment Council?
Representative Merkley, Chairman, it has indeed. There have been several initiatives over the past couple of years, and Mike can elaborate on this if he likes. We took on, for example, a couple of years ago, we used to delegate the voting of proxies to our investment managers that were hired by the council. That was taken on internally in the sense that we hired an outside separate evaluation firm to do proxy voting for us. The council is involved in identifying the policies by which that organization does the voting. There have been a couple of instances, and specifics escape me at the moment, but a couple of instances where members of the council wrote letters on particular governance issues that were hot. I think Disney may have been one. I don't quote me on that, but there were a couple over the last couple of years where there were letters to either individual companies or to the SEC that the council has wrote, and that's a little more ad hoc. Chair Edwards, Treasurer Edwards, as you may be aware, has been involved in several things through NAST and other organizations. Nothing quite as overt or as active as California, to date anyway.
Representative Nelson. Thank you for this information, Mr. Schmitz. Could you let me know, under each one of these categories, the large, the small, and this regional fund, is it possible to know what opportunities have been looked at and which ones you've invested in or the partners have invested in the state?
Representative Nelson, Chairlin, I can identify, at this point we can identify what has been invested in. We do that once a year in the Treasurer's Annual Report. It's a little more difficult through the fund-to-funds operation because they're a little more secretive with respect to the underlying data, but we do try to get that. We have not asked historically for managers to tell us what opportunities they've looked at and passed on, for example, which is, I think, part of your question. We anticipate doing that going forward. Certainly Credit Suisse is going to be doing that within the OIF. We will try to do that with our other relationships as well, but we have not historically asked them to report on what they've looked at and passed on within the state, only what they've invested in.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. For example, in the new private-public partnerships that we permitted ODOT, for example, in developing a bypass happens to be in my area, you know, which is a $300 million investment. My concern is, wouldn't it be more prudent to keep the money in Oregon, if at all possible, rather understand there are 10 funds and they're all outside of the state? I mean, I'm just worrying about some of these, just like the purchase of several properties right now by the state of California. Here in Oregon, we seem to be investing everywhere but in our own state.
Representative Nelson, Chairman, I'm not sure I would agree with that characterization. 10% of the private equity program is in Oregon. I don't know what Oregon's, or out of hand, what Oregon's percentage of the national economy is, but I suspect it's less than 10%. So I think on a pro rata basis or a percentage basis, we're probably over-invested in that sense. Now, that doesn't mean there couldn't be more investment or there aren't opportunities here that should be looked at, but I don't think it's a fair representation to say we're avoiding the state or not doing a representative percentage within the state.
Representative Dallum.
Thank you, Chairman Lim. Given the charge of the Investment Committee, I would like to be certain that when the legislature earmarks a certain investment in Oregon, has that in any way diminished your ability to maximize return on investment?
I represent Alan, Chair Lim. I don't think so, but that was, it's a concern anytime you get a specific mandate or mandated action that starts to kind of narrow you down a little bit. The prudent investor standard is something that the council takes very importantly and that the staff takes very importantly. We're very pleased that we think that the program we've come up with Credit Suisse doesn't compromise return and our duty to the pension fund beneficiaries, but that is always a danger when you get into economically targeted kind of investing.
The answer would be no, then.
Pardon?
The answer would be it hasn't inhibited you.
We don't think so.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Do you also handle the Oregon's PERS account also?
I'm sorry, which account?
Oh.
The pension fund.
Oregon's public...
Oh, Portland?
Yeah.
PERS.
PERS.
For the city of Portland?
No, he means...
No, Oregon State.
He means the pension fund. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. How much is in the total amount in the PERS at this time?
Chairman, PERS right now at year end was approximately $48 billion.
$48 billion?
Yes.
Okay. Since the depression... of the stock, did we lost some money, or how much we lost money last 3 years or so, if we lost any money?
Chairman, certainly during the market decline, we did lose money. Do you know the three-year number right offhand, Mike?
I don't.
The three-year number is actually positive. For PERS overall, I don't know the exact number, but there was a period in 2001-2002 where returns were negative.
Okay.
I think the net return in 2002 was minus 8% approximately.
Okay.
It was up 20% last year.
Okay, 20% last year?
Yes.
That has been pretty good. And when is the Treasury's report coming out, all of those PERS and including many other investments, when is coming out, Treasury's report?
Typically, it's the latter half of the year. So right now, we're working on the numbers I gave you, the $470 million in Oregon-based Oregon companies, is from a 2003 audited report. We generally get the data somewhere in the second quarter, make that available, and then it goes through the process that it's turned over to another Department of Treasury. And I think in the past, it's come out in the third quarter, probably late summer.
Chair Lim and members of the committee, I'm Mike Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments for the Treasury. But if you're interested in the performance of the pension fund for the last 5 years, 3 years, 1 year, say ended December, we can provide that to you today.
Okay. Thank you. Please provide that each member of it. And then I'd like to follow up the questions of Representative Nelson concerning the investment in our state. Did you say you are going to provide each one of us the information, or is it secretive?
We can make available to you. At this point, we have solid numbers from 12/31/03. We can get some kind of unaudited numbers for you as of the third quarter, September 30th of 04.
Okay.
But those would be only investments in Oregon. That wouldn't include companies that were opportunities that were looked at and passed on by the general partners, because that's just not data we collect.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Just very quickly, but that would be public information, would it not? My concern is when we have these outside fund managers, do they consider that that information of what opportunities they looked at is public information?
Representative Nelson, Chairman, that's a good question. Some of them may. And in fact, the fund of funds managers generally do take a little bit more restrictive view. So we may have a little trouble getting it from some. It could be that we might, typically what we report is just the name of the company and the fair market value of the investment. Going beyond that is where the general partners usually balk. You know, what kind of investment, what kind of plans do they have for the company, you know, those kind of things are things that they generally balk at. But we would report publicly available information.
I think it is very important for us to know how much that invested in our state to make that informative policy decision on the issue of economy and investment. So since it is a public money and we need to know all the information if it's available, I do appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman.
All right, we'll be moving on to the next. Mike Mueller, Assistant Director of Investment, Oregon State Treasury. Welcome, Mike, again.
Thank you, Chair Lim, members of the committee. Again, I'm Mike Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments. Shifting gears a little bit from what the Oregon Investment Council does, as you know, there's another investment vehicle focused on Oregon investing, appropriately called the Oregon Growth Account. It was created within the Education Stability Fund during the 1995 legislative session in conjunction with the establishment of the Education Stability Fund. So it was approximately 10 years ago. The first investment was made in 1999, which unfortunately was at the peak of the internet bubble, if you recall, the tech internet bubble. So some of the early investments will probably turn out not to be as successful as we had initially hoped. But I'll talk about some more specifics about what's in that program in a few minutes. So in accordance with the revisions of the Constitution creating the ESF, the Educational Stability Fund receives 18% of the net lottery proceeds, and of the lottery proceeds placed in the Economic Education Stability Fund, 10% flow into the Oregon Growth Account. That's a long-winded way to say that it's approximately $1 million to $1.2 million per quarter that flow into this account. The statutes governing the OGA, which is the acronym for the Oregon Growth Account, require that the OGA earn returns for the Higher Education Technology Transfer Fund by making investments in or providing seed capital for emerging growth businesses in key industries in Oregon. A separate board other than the Oregon Investment Council, which is chaired by the state treasurer, is responsible for the investments of the Oregon Growth Account. And I'll quickly cover who the members are, not by name, but by statute. The state treasurer serves as chairman by statute. Three members are appointed by the governor from a list of candidates recommended by the treasurer who are qualified by training and experience in the field of venture capital and emerging growth business. And the final three members are from the general public appointed by the governor from a list of candidates recommended by the treasurer. So it's a seven-member board, meets quarterly. The purpose of the growth account, again, is to earn returns for the Higher Education Technology Transfer Fund. And the key distinction we try to make with our general partners, again, is we can't find general partners who will invest exclusively in Oregon. So the objective is that they invest primarily in Oregon. And as defined in law, that means that when we commit, say a general partner is raising a $20 million fund, the Oregon Growth Account decides they want to be $2 million of that $20 million commitment. The general partners have agreed that at least $2 million will come back and be invested in Oregon companies. OGA funds will only be invested through external managers and partners. That is, once the money is committed, the managers act with full discretion. They are totally responsible for the investment of these funds with the partnerships within the partnership's investment guidelines. The OGA board and treasury staff are involved in the selection, retention, and monitoring of these external managers, but we do not entertain individual investment proposals from businesses for particular projects. These are entirely at the discretion of the general partners. Hopefully you have a handout. I think it's a spreadsheet, actually, and I'll What I'd like to do is just briefly go over the investments that have been made by the Oregon Growth Account to date. Again, the program began in 1995, but investments began in 1999. To date, over $40 million has been committed to 8 general partners, 5 of which are located in Oregon, 3 are based in the Seattle or Washington area. Of that $40 million, these general partners have called or requested approximately $20 million to be invested in companies. Some of these companies are based in Oregon, some of these companies are not based in Oregon. I provided you a summary of the investments made in Oregon, and to date it's 30 companies, which includes 20 current investments, 3 which have been sold, and 7 which have been written off or at a loss, essentially. You also requested a little background on the Oregon Resource Technology and Development Account. Prior to the 2001 legislative session, the assets of the Oregon Resource Technology and Development Account were invested and managed under the authority of a board outside the purview of the Oregon State Treasury, so I don't have any information on how that program was run or operated. But during the 2001 session, in accordance with House Bill 3968, that provided for the transfer of the assets from the Oregon Resource Technology and Development Account to the Oregon Growth Account, and it was defined as a special sub-account. So essentially what happened is we took the remaining assets of the Oregon Resource Technology and Development Account and rolled them in to the Oregon Growth Account as a separate account. And if you look at this other flow chart that was provided, you'll see that we indeed did segregate it off as a separate fund. That fund, that partnership, was capitalized with proceeds from sales of the investments in the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Account of approximately $10 million. Additionally, $4 million was provided by inflows into the Oregon Growth Account. And lastly, the general partner agreed to manage the remaining assets from the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Account, which consisted of approximately 54 separate assets, debt, equity, warrants, other interests in 17 small Oregon companies. Recently, those 17 companies were valued at just under, or just about $525,000. So these are investments that were made where we do not expect to see a significant return, if any, on the capital that was invested in those companies.
I'd like to ask questions. Concerning the Oregon ORTDA, what was the total amount that transferred to the Oregon Growth Account? Is that $14 million, this total amount?
Chair Lim, I believe it was approximately $11.5 million was the value of the portfolio. That included cash and assets.
Okay. Since the state invested in this ORTDF or ORTDA, did they make some money for the state, or did they lost money? What was the history of it until the time of transfer to the Oregon Investment Council?
Chair Lim, unfortunately, I don't have the history of that program. The Oregon Growth Account Board undertook an audit or evaluation audit of the securities at the time of transfer, which is approximately June of 2001. So we only established a fair market value as of that point in time. So I don't have any history in terms of cost basis or realizations of investments that occurred prior to that.
Okay, I'd like to have some information. I'd like to determine that since the state invested in this account, I'd like to know how much total investment was, and what was the return was it, and what was the success in the past investment. I'd like to have some information on it.
Senator Lim, I'd like to provide that information, and maybe we can work with others, but again, it was outside the purview of the state treasury at that time, but we can certainly look to see where we can find that information, but it's not within our control. There wasn't investments for which we had responsibility, but we can search and see if we can find who is appropriate to get you that answer.
Please. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mr. Muter, where did the original money come from, and who did manage it if the Treasury didn't?
There was a separate board, the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Board.
Under Under whom, though? Under the governor? Under the Department of Administration, budget, or what? Who?
Again, it's a program that the Treasury inherited, so we took the assets in, and the history of the program I'm not familiar with.
So you don't know who managed it previously?
I believe it was a management group managed by Wayne Embry, Cascadia Management Company, but beyond that, I don't know anything about the selection, retention, or performance that they had.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And so where did the $11.5 million of assets come from?
Chair Lim, Representative Nelson, it came from the assets that were in that account at the time that it was transferred to the Oregon Growth account.
So where did that come from?
It came from the prior management company.
What was the source of the of the money, the assets?
It was lottery money.
Okay. Thank you.
Pardon, Nick. Kay, you'd like to join us? You have something to say?
I'm just providing the information.
So okay, that's fine. Yeah. All right. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, sir. Can I ask a question about the spreadsheet? Let me chair in front of it. My understanding is that in terms of returns, so far $20 million have gone, roughly have been called on that account. Is that right?
Representative, that's correct.
And there's been a $7.6 million return of capital on that $20 million, plus its current value is $16 million. Is that the way I'm reading? I'm reading the last
Chair Lim, Representative Greenlee, it would be the sum of the fair market value of the remaining investments plus what's been realized is that $16 million that you see.
And the fair market value is?
8.3.
So there's essentially $24 million total. $4 million have been returns on that. Is that the a net $4 million? Is that?
Chair Lim, Representative Greenlee, let me explain it this way. $20 million has been called or invested by the general partners. Of that, they've returned $7.6 million, and they continue to hold a portfolio that's estimated to be worth $8.3 million. That's a combined $16 million in fair value.
That's a combined $16 million. So okay, I'm good.
The delta there would be $4 million.
Got it. Sure. $4 million. Thank you.
And I'd like to follow up one more question. The $40 million transfer from the OLTBA to this Oregon Investment Council, the Oregon Growth account, you mentioned about $11 million is the portfolio out of this 14.
Correct.
Okay. Is that the portfolio any worth of it, just valuing it, or actually that has been $11 million is worth? It's still that much value we have.
Chair Lim, that portfolio that we inherited had two significant assets that were publicly traded securities, which were liquidated in 2001. AVI Biopharma and WebMD were two significant holdings. They were liquidated with a realization of approximately $10 million. So that was cash that was returned to the Oregon Growth account and set aside for investment in this Oregon Resource Technology and Development sub-account within the growth account. And then additionally, $4 million came from lottery proceeds in accordance with the statute as it was written.
Okay. Thank you. So are you done?
Yes, sir.
All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Thank you.
Sorry.
That's all right. Again, just to make sure I'm very clear on this, with the investment starting in 1999, so we've had 5 years of investment thus far, and going back to the same thing Representative Greenlee was asking about, with approximately $20 million investment, the fair market value in return adding up to $16 million. So we've had a loss of $4 million, did I have that correctly, in the past 5 years?
Yeah, Chair Lim, Representative Buckley, that is correct, but it's not uncommon in this type of investing. Typically, we pay out management fees in the investment period, which is the first 3 to 5 years, and these companies take some time to generate returns or realizations, and it's typically the out years, 5 to 10 years out, where we'd expect to see a capital return. So while there are certainly issues within this portfolio, we're hopeful that the additional capital to be called, as well as the realization of these companies down the road, that loss will diminish or, in fact, turn positive.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
Do you have a projection of growth in these in this investment of any even rough number by any rough year?
Chair Lim, Representative Buckley, this is perhaps one of the highest risk types of investments. We're talking early in seed stage when these companies are really struggling, and certainly you hope that in the long run, you know going in that if you fund 10 companies, that 4 to 5 of them, perhaps even more, will not be around anymore when this fund is terminated. But you hope that there are enough survivors that are successful, that it pays to invest. So we're really relying on the expertise of the general partners with whom we contract to successfully execute these. And again, in Oregon, it's a strategy that is difficult, although we are finding that there are more and more general partners, not only within Oregon, but within the state of Washington, that have shown an interest in investing in Oregon.
Very good. One more question, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Could you please provide a short description of the Higher Education Technology Transfer Fund for me?
Chair Lim, Representative Buckley, I can't do that. Our mission is to earn returns for that fund. We hope to declare earnings down the road, and I know the Treasurer does. But beyond that, I can't tell you what that fund's mission is.
Advise me of where I could look to try to find out.
We will get that answer for you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Out of the $46 or $8 billion in the personal account, what percentage do you think you can, that the Oregon Investment Council invest in the stocks, and what is the percentage that in the stock out of the total amount in the portfolio?
Chair Lim, the pension fund asset allocation targets are 35% U.S. equities, 20% international equities, 27% bonds, 8% real estate, 10% private equity, and I hope that added to 100.
It does.
Somebody check them.
Why don't you go over those again, Mr. Chair? Could we have those again?
Yes, please. 35% U.S. equity.
Okay.
20% international.
Oh, 20%?
20. Okay. 27
international, right?
International.
Okay.
27% bonds. 8% real estate, and 10% private equity.
10% of what?
Private equity, venture capital buyout funds, and so forth.
Okay.
So I might add, just as a little color, if you compare the pension fund in Oregon compared to, you know, nationally, the averages, we're probably a little high in our private equity exposure. Typical is more like 4 or 5%, 6%. But the other asset classes are reasonably well in balance with our peers.
Okay, so U.S. and international total portfolio is about the 55%.
That's correct, Senator Chair.
Is it not clear in the statute that the not more than 50% should be invested in the portfolio, according to my memory is correct?
Chairman, the statute calls for a 50% limitation on contributed capital, not market value. The numbers I gave you are based on market value.
Okay, how do you define that 50%? The point I'm trying to get it, is it a total amount of 50%, or are there 50% of the money growth out of it that you consider as a 50%? What is the definition of 50%?
Chair Lim, you're asking a very difficult question. I don't think, for whatever reason, records have not been kept with respect to the 50% of contributed capital. But if you consider the fact that over a 20-year period, the portfolio grew at probably low double-digit rates, 50% of contributed capital is much lower.
I know.
Or is a much different number than, and that would grow and allow a percentage of fair market value to be much higher than 50%. You know, we're comfortable or very confident that the 55% combined for U.S. and international equity meets the spirit of that 50%, but we don't have the accounting has just never been done historically to track it the way that that statute reads. And in fact, we've considered from time to time, you know, asking for a redefinition of that limitation. But I'm not sure, you know, why that hasn't happened to date. But
so do you have any opinions from the Attorney General that the definition of the 50%, or do you take your own definition of 50%? I'd like to clarify that point.
Chairlin, I don't know that we have a formal opinion of any sort, but what we've done within staff is some kind of back-of-the-envelope calculations with the accounting, the finance department of Treasury that's separate from the investment division, and done some just rough calculations of historical contributions, and we have a comfort level that we're within that, but again, we don't have a specific number, and we don't have, to my knowledge anyway, unless somebody knows of one I don't know about, a specific opinion from the AG's office.
All right.
May I call?
Yes, Representative Greenleek.
Are you saying you don't have the cost base on those 55%?
We have the cost. If you look at the current portfolio, we have market and we have cost, but we don't have cost that goes back and rolls forward the 50% of contributed cost over history. Those are two different things. If you buy and sell, for example, if I bought and sold a security last month, I'd have a new cost basis in my portfolio. So the conventional, you know, the way this is accounted for in the custodian bank circles and by everybody, not just Oregon, is that cost basis at the time you make an investment. But we don't have, for whatever reason, and I don't know why, you know, I can't tell you why, but we've not rolled forward that particular calculation and that restriction from years ago forward. We can just make rough estimates and feel comfortable within it, but we don't have a solid number.
Okay.
Chair Lim, Representative Greenleek, the statute actually reads monies contributed shall not exceed 50%. I believe the pension fund began investing in equities in the late 60s, and certainly we know the appreciation of equities from 68 to 2005 has been quite substantial, so that we're quite comfortable that at 55%, we're nowhere near that 50% limitation.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mr. Mueller, is it possible to know what companies receive these monies?
Chair Lim, Representative Nelson, I can provide that to you.
Thank you very much. And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, when you provide, please provide to the each members also. Thank you.
Were either of you involved in the investment in the large maintenance hangar at the Portland Airport?
I'm talking about.
Chair, I'm Representative Nelson. I'm happy to say no. No current Treasury staff was involved in that transaction. We're involved in managing it and trying to work our way out of it currently, but the initial the original transaction is by people well before us.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm so glad, and I thought so. What I wanted to know is, what is your strategy to cure the problem, and why are we taking so long?
Chair Lim, Representative Nelson, it is indeed taking a long time. We have made very concerted efforts to try to lease up and to try to, you know, make the facility profitable. We've been able to do so on an operating basis. Last year we actually operated in the black, if you will. But that's purely operating, and that's before the bond obligation. leasehold payments to the port start June, I believe, of this year. And at that point, you know, we were in discussions with the port now about what to do going forward.
A final question. Because of that, and at the time I certainly was in the same business, and had we been even asked, you know, about the viability of that program, we would have certainly given the state of Oregon some good advice, since we were the only hometown carrier. But what safeguards have been put into place since that investment to prevent that from happening again?
Chair Lim, Representative Nelson, and Mike, please jump in if you know of something here that should be added. I can't speak to what's happened before my time. I've been here for a couple of years now. But I know one of the things the council looks at now in making any investment is that our partners have skin in the game, as it were, and that they invest alongside us. And I think one of the problems...
I'm sorry, Mr. Schmidt, couldn't understand what you said.
I'm sorry. The council likes to make investments now or demands that our partners, when we make investments, have money alongside OPERF's money so they have something to lose and that aligns interest. I don't think that was the case with the hangar, and I think that was one of the key problems, or one of the key things that led to problems.
And Senator, Representative Williams, and Representative Nelson. You used to be a senator, I know.
Right.
That.
Just to be. We have to say Senator Representing Chairman.
One of the things I think that they've done to mitigate that is this was not really an investment per se. It was a bond guarantee, guaranteeing the debt of the Port of Portland. And it was sort of a one-off local investment, if you will. And it's one of the reasons that we're perhaps cautionary about simply investing because it's in our backyard. And this is an investment that speaks volumes about doing your due diligence, doing your homework, and doing what's right for the plan beneficiaries as opposed to what may be most expedient or have the best appearance. And I think that the council, and I know the Treasury staff, having read the history and lived through the history, has learned a valuable lesson that all investments will be judged exclusively on their return merits, and economic development, while beneficial, and we all hope the best for the state of Oregon, is going to be of secondary importance to us.
Final question then, Mr. Chair, please.
Final question.
I don't recall, it seems like it was $40 million of the public employees' monies, $200 million total. I'm just trying to remember from back then. But in the case of this investment, but it still holds us liable for this burden, even though this, the owner of this had a poor financial condition to begin with, and on the recommendation of the general partner, I mean, why aren't they held responsible for this?
Representative Nelson, Chair Lim, I think there are a variety of court actions underway, and the principals, I think, I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say.
If I may?
Yes, please, identify your name first.
For the record, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff of the State Treasurer. There is still a court case that is sitting right now in between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, and there is a judgment in that case, although because it's still on appeal, we haven't been able to collect, and it's hard to know how much we will be able to collect in the long run. There was also, we had a bond, a liability bond, that has paid out as well on this, so there has been some return for the losses.
How much was, excuse me?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Kate, how much was that?
There was more than one bond, and I'm sorry, I only know the most recent.
Could we have a position report on this issue? Would it be all right? Please.
Indeed. The most recent bond recovery was $5.4 million. And there was a prior one before that, but I hesitate to get the number. I just don't have it here. The judgment, I think... in the court case was a approximately $60 million judgment pending that would be coming back to the PERS fund as well.
Thank you.
All right. No further questions this time. Thank you very much for your presentation. That has been very helpful. I appreciate it. And there being no further business to come before the committee, and before that, yes, that seemed like to make a couple.
I wanted to mention to the members that on Wednesday we have the gambling issues session here in the committee, and there's a news release that's going out later today on this. I've given you a copy of that news release. I also wanted to remind you that on the 25th of February we'll be going to the Dalles. We have yet to firm up what the schedule will be, but it will be an all-day trip to the Dalles. And then we have given to us after your session last Monday from the Oregon Forest Resources Institute this binder. I'll give each of you a copy of that with a letter, and then we will put this information into the record for last Monday for people who are looking for this.
Okay. And we are looking forward to going to the Dalles, and we are excited, especially thank you, Representative Dallum, for preparing all of those meetings, and we do appreciate it. With that, the meeting of TNE, we are adjourned.
Thank you very much.